Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting a new call from the U.S. for the Syrian leader to step down. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad must step down, but the timing of his departure has to be decided through negotiation. Speaking in London after talks with the British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, Kerry urged Russia and Iran to use their influence in Syria to convince Assad to negotiate.
We need to get to the negotiation. That's what we're looking for. And we hope Russia and any Iran, other countries with influence, will help to bring about that, because that's what's preventing this crisis from ending.
The violence continues in Syria. A watchdog group said Islamist insurgents killed 56 members of Syrian government forces in the country's northwest Idlib province. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the government fighters were shot execution style at the Abu Duhura military airport. The monitoring group said the killings happened earlier this week, but it took several days to confirm the deaths. Some 250,000 people have been killed during Syria's nearly five-year-long civil war. Some of those Syrians who have fled their country most likely were part of about 3,000 migrants welcomed by Austria in two locations early Saturday. Some 1,500 migrants and refugees crossed from Hungary into Austria on foot at the border town of Nickelsdorf, where they were met by police and Red Cross workers who ushered them onto buses headed to Vienna. And about 1,600 migrants who on buses provided by Hungary arrived in another Austrian border town, where they boarded buses to Vienna. This is VOA News. Pope Francis begins a 10-day trip to Cuba and the United States Saturday, embarking on his first trip to the one-time Cold War foes after helping to nudge forward their historic rapprochement. He'll be offering a show of solidarity with Cubans and making clear that Hispanics in the United States are the bedrock of the American church. The visit boasts several firsts for history's first Latin American pope. Francis will become the first pope to address the U.S. Congress. He'll also proclaim the first saint on U.S. soil by canonizing the controversial and Hispanic missionary Junipero Serra. Francis, though, will also be following in the footsteps of his predecessors, becoming the third pontiff to visit Cuba over the past 17 years, and he'll join three of his predecessors in grabbing the world stage at the United Nations to press his agenda on migration, the environment, and religious persecution, while over 100 world leaders listen in. Anti-coup demonstrators burned tires at roadblocks in Burkina Faso's capital on Saturday as West African mediators continued pursuing a negotiated resolution to that country's political crisis following the toppling of the transitional government earlier this week. North of the city center, smoke rose from barricades where crowds chanted slogans denouncing General Gilbert Diendéré, who was named leader of Burkina Faso Thursday after members of the elite presidential security regiment stormed a government meeting and detained the acting president and prime minister. Soldiers from the regiment fired on protesters after the coup was announced, killing at least six people, but they had little presence on the streets of Ouagadougou Saturday, emboldening demonstrators who cried out, "Homeland or death." China wants all parties in the North Korean denuclearization talks to resume the long-stalled negotiations. Speaking at an academic forum in Beijing, Foreign Minister Wang Yi called on all sides to take a responsible attitude and refrain from any actions that could worsen tensions both on the Korean Peninsula and the whole of Northeast Asia. The forum was organized to mark the 10th anniversary of a joint agreement reached between Pyongyang and five world powers, China, South Korea, Japan, Russia, and the United States, to remove all nuclear weapons from the peninsula. However, the negotiations collapsed in 2008 when North Korea refused to allow inspections to verify compliance and declared the deal was void. It has since conducted three nuclear tests, the last one in 2013, and recently said it has restarted operations at its main nuclear complex in Yongbyon. Israel has carried out airstrikes in the Gaza Strip Saturday after Palestinian militants there fired rockets into southern Israel.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
In a way, someone was making a study or doing a study on Swaziland with regard to our political situation or democracy itself.
Swaziland rejects the latest Afrobarometer poll results that highlight demands for democracy and rule of law.
The junta should step aside and allow preparations for October elections to resume immediately. The United States stands squarely with the people of Burkina Faso.
U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice says the junta in Burkina Faso should step aside.
We are ready now for the by-elections. We shall be deploying polling officers to their respective polling stations, and they will be carrying with them the relevant voting materials.
And Zimbabweans vote in by-elections in parts of the country today. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. He is an internationally recognized authority in fiber optics and nanotechnology and also a renowned scientist and inventor. Dr. Thomas Mensah is currently the president and CEO of the Georgia Aerospace Systems. He joins us live via telephone link up here in Washington, D.C. Good afternoon, Dr. Mensah.
Good afternoon, Peter.
How are you, sir?
Doing very well.
Wonderful. So tell me, you have been recognized internationally as well as here in the U.S. about your work on fiber optic, which has enabled some of us to communicate with Africa and beyond. What are you working now?
Well, basically, I am still one of the leaders in the field of both fiber optics and nanotechnology. And the companies that I founded, Georgia Aerospace, as well as Lightwave Systems, are focused in really bringing this technology to the far corners of this planet. Of course, as you know, we were the first to develop fiber optics in the United States so that laser-based fiber optic cable transmission can allow pictures, videos, photos, whether it's photos from Facebook or Instagram, so that they can reach from America to China or from China to Africa. Everywhere.
Now, Dr. Mensah, what impact do you think your invention, the impact of your work is having specifically on Africa?
Well, this invention of fiber optics and transmission media is so important, not only in America, but particularly in Africa. For example, democratic freedoms have been a problem in some places, especially in Africa. And if you remember, in North Africa, most of the people use tweets and Facebook to send messages out when they have been banned from talking to people or from appearing on television. But just by taking your cell phone and taking a picture of something and putting it on the internet, the fiber optics allow you to send those pictures to America, to all the freedom-loving world. And so fiber optics has impacted democracy as well as the political process. In addition, of course, everybody is happy to, whenever a child is born in Africa, to be able to send the photos of that baby to a distant family in America or Europe or every place else. So fiber optics is really very, very important to the continent. And my company, Lightwave Systems, is really moving forward to make sure that the entire regions in Africa will be connected with the wonders of fiber optic cable. Because with fiber optics, as you know, you can send an entire encyclopedia data to places so people can be able to shop online, actually buy things through their cell phones or make payments to a bank or transfer money. So fiber optics is going to be very, very important on the continent. The penetration rate of fiber optics on the continent is only 5%.
Let me ask you quickly about this. How is the cooperation of these countries in Africa, over 50 of them so far, to embrace this technology or perhaps a transfer of technology to help with the development of or the embrace of this nanotechnology and fiber optics?
Well, first of all, for example, as you know, a fiber optic submarine cable has been installed from Spain around the curves of West Africa all the way to South Africa, and also from South Africa. So you're going to have Africa encircled by these submarine cables. My second invention made the submarine cable possible because you produce strong fiber optic systems that can be cabled and put on the sea so that it can withstand the stresses and forces when it's placed on the sea. So which means if Africa is encircled with fiber optics, all the countries need to do is to tap into these submarine cable and then splice it and then send it terrestrially all over Ghana, all over Nigeria, all over Democratic Republic of Congo, all over Angola, all over South Africa, all the way around to Ethiopia. And so right now what we have is what is called satellite transmission system. So you have those satellite dishes, which, as you and I know, when you're watching cable news network, there's always a delay. So you can't use that for faster communication. You got to have the fiber optics networks, terrestrial networks, that are in place. So we are working with the government, and all the 50 governments at this stage, if they want to be, the three infrastructures, as you and I know, Peter, that they need in Africa right now is transportation, fiber optics and telecommunication system, and finally energy and electric power. Those three. If they get that, they'll be as advanced as any other country.
Thank you very much. That was Dr. Thomas Mensah, currently the president and CEO of the Georgia Aerospace Systems and an internationally recognized authority in fiber optics and nanotechnology. He joined us live from Washington. Swaziland's government has rejected the latest Afrobarometer poll results. They highlight demands for democracy and rule of law in the Southern African Kingdom. Spokesman Percy Simelane told me that it is obvious that the survey was conducted to tarnish the reputation of the country and not intentioned to help Swazis. He says they support the rule of the monarchy, which is guaranteed by the constitution.
We are not even aware someone was making a study or doing a study on Swaziland with regard to our political situation or democracy itself. Our understanding and our experience is that they do these reports or these surveys not to help Swaziland to get better, but to kind of put Swaziland on the spotlight, negatively. Swaziland is a democratic country. We are following a constitution that was put together by the Swazi people. We do not have political prisoners, no Swazi refugees, and in any refugee camp anywhere in the world. So I believe that Swazis are happy with the system because even before the elections, only 2 years ago, the king and government allow the people to say whether or not they still wanted to continue with the way the constitution says we should. And the people said they still want the constitution followed to the latter.
But the king has on many occasions said that he oversees the country in a monarchical democracy. But it appears that the way the democracy is working under the king, they are not pleased with it. And they said that nearly three quarters or 73% said they were not at all free to join any political organization if they wanted to, because political parties are banned from participating in elections in Swaziland. And the report also said that they are not even free to air their opinions. That is part of the Constitution that guarantees freedom of speech is undermined by the administration. What do you say to that?
The government also has no power over the Constitution because it is not the government of Swaziland that put the Constitution together. It was put together by the people of Swaziland. The government and the people of Swaziland are following a constitution that was put together by the people. Let me go back to the word monarchical or phrase monarchical democracy. The king explained why he used that English word. Otherwise, the Swazi people are following what is called Tingunza system of government. Tingunza simply means constituencies, which means the people choose their leaders, as opposed to situations whereby political party leaders impose themselves on the people. It is explained in the Constitution that while we have political parties, political leaders who want to go to parliament have to be chosen by constituencies in which they live, so that when they get to parliament, they represent not just their political parties, but the people that live in that constituency. Because, as explained by the people of Swaziland, the reason was that if political parties send their political leaders to parliament, people who do not have parties won't be represented by the people who are only representing their political parties. It is not government that decided that political leaders who are in constituencies should represent everybody. They are free to say whatever they want to say to everybody in the constituency, as opposed to a situation whereby they only talk to their political parties. So government does not have any power on the constitution. If the people of Swaziland who put together the constitution that you are following today wanted to change anything, they are free to do that, and they know how to change it. We just have to follow the constitution as it is until it is amended by the people.
Percy Similani is the spokesman for Swaziland government. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice says the junta in Burkina Faso should step aside and allow elections next month. Mariama Diallo reports.
Susan Rice says the United States and the international community are united in responding to the crisis in Burkina Faso.
The junta should step aside and allow preparations for October elections to resume immediately. The United States stands squarely with the people of Burkina Faso in rejecting this threat to their democratic progress.
Speaking at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation's legislative conference in Washington, Rice says the U.S. is reviewing its assistance to the West African country. In an ever-changing political landscape in Africa, Rice said more work to end old mindsets and address entrenched challenges needs to be done even after four presidential trips to the region, a historic summit in Washington, and signature development initiatives. She took a moment to praise the work of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Over the years, your leadership and that of the entire CBC has built a bipartisan consensus that gets things done for Africa, from fighting apartheid to supporting PEPFAR, from confronting the genocide in Darfur and easing the suffering of the people of South Sudan to tackling the Ebola crisis in West Africa.
U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass, who sponsored the event, says it's important to move forward on trade, health, and governance a year after the landmark U.S.-Africa summit.
We started off the day by talking about the Ebola crisis, the fact that it's over, but the fact that the crisis revealed the need to really develop the health infrastructure in Africa. And then, of course, after the extension of AGOA was passed, we have a panel that's talking about trade. And now that AGOA has passed, let's really fast forward the implementation.
The African Growth and Opportunity Act offers trade incentives for African countries to open their economies and build free markets. Chevron Manager for International Affairs, who participated in the AGOA panel, made a plea to U.S. investors to encourage stable democracies.
When you look at Africa, think about the three P's: patience, physical presence, and partnership. This is the last frontier, and there are a lot of tremendous opportunities. Second, to the U.S. government, infrastructure is critical.
But he also asked African governments to enable an environment for Africans and foreign companies to come, feel safe, and then operate. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Sierra Leone is one of the West African countries that was severely hit by the Ebola virus last year. The deadly disease had a serious impact on many sectors, including education. Madupe Taylor-Pierce is a board member of the Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency and an education activist. Reporter Douglas Impuga asked him whether schooling has now recovered from the ravages of Ebola.
The education system has not recovered, neither has the country. I mean, as you probably know, we are in the tail end of the Ebola virus disease. The good news is that we're now chasing the virus instead of the virus chasing us, and any new infections are coming from people who are under observation, which means that we have it mostly under control, and we hope to be done with the virus or be declared Ebola-free, hopefully before Christmas. On the education front, prior to the Ebola virus, I mean, Sierra Leone was the standard of education and access to education was certainly not very good and in fact, lagging many other countries within West Africa. The Ebola virus took us even further behind because for about 8 months, the children of Sierra Leone were unable to go to school when they should have been in school. So pretty much from the period of August, September 2014 till early May 2015, there was no school, and which is understandable because of the health challenges.
So, as things stand now, what needs to be done to bring it up to speed?
There were some interventions that were made during the Ebola time. For example, the Ministry of Education, Science and Technology initiated some radio instructions. Those had, frankly, minimal impact, but it was something that was better than nothing. Now, since the time that when we restarted the schools and the planning started to get children back to school, the government took a bold step of restarting schools, even though we were not completely Ebola-free, but we felt that the risk level was low enough to be able to get the children back into school. So that's the positive side of what has happened. On the downside of some of the things that happened is that in the rush to get things back to school, the private sector, which is a significant participant in the education sphere in Sierra Leone, was really not consulted in how to effectively make up for the lost time that the children had gone through. And so the ministry went through, because there were some very practical challenges. For example, what schedule shall we adopt? Well, now that we've lost 8 months and we're starting in April of 2015, what do we do? Do we compress the schedule? Do we always operated under a three-term system in Sierra Leone. Do we still operate under a three-term and compress it so that the kids can get the contact hours that they do need? Or do we modify that in some way? And the Ministry of Education and the Board of Education, in its wisdom, went ahead and adjusted the schedule to a two-term schedule that would run from April to December, with a six-week break from mid-July to the end of August, without really consulting the private sector in terms of those that are participating in education. And that has created some challenges.
In all this, how helpful has the donor community, your development partners, been in making sure that you put your education system on track?
The donor community has been positively involved financially, especially in the area of getting these kids back to school safely. And by that, I mean providing the funds for things like, washing buckets, soap, detergent, making sure that there's running water in the schools. And that is very, very important because, you know, the safety of the children is our primary concern. From a technical assistance with the donor community, I'm not sure that they have been tremendously involved, primarily because a lot of the resources on technical assistance has been in the area of, you know, really sort of getting us down to zero on the health side.
Madupe Taylor Pierce is a board member of the Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency, an education activist. He spoke with reporter Douglas Mpuga from Washington. Meanwhile, heavy flooding in Freetown, Sierra Leone, has killed at least 12 people and displaced thousands more from homes that were damaged or destroyed. Emergency accommodations have been set up at the National Stadium to help deal with the disaster. For VOA, Nina DeVries files from the capital of Freetown.
People are sitting in the bleachers. Some are laying on mattresses provided, while others line up for food and water. Naomi Karoma is one of the thousands of people displaced. She sits in the packed stadium cradling her newborn, only 2 days old. Karoma says she's scared and confused. Her house is still standing in her community called Congo Town, but not her belongings.
All my things in my house were damaged. Money, my clothes, all my items, everything just washed away.
According to Andreas Kassai, a communication specialist for UNICEF, almost 4,000 people have been registered so far at the stadium. He says a UN agency is helping women like Karoma by offering a medical clinic for children under five. He adds that with an Ebola crisis still in effect, things can be challenging. Sierra Leone was on a 42-day countdown to being declared Ebola-free, but two districts are now in quarantine after two deaths and several new cases.
The floods have come at a particularly difficult time as Sierra Leone is fighting to reach zero in terms of Ebola. And yes, indeed, and the affected communities are amongst some of the high-risk communities for Ebola in the Freetown area. So definitely the Ebola response is part of the overall package that is being provided by UNICEF and partners here at the stadium.
He says crowding at the stadium can create risks for other diseases. So the response includes making sure proper hygiene is in place, such as additional clean toilets and hand washing facilities. Sierra Leone faces floods during its annual rainy season, but the effect of flooding this week was particularly bad. Deputy Government Spokesman Ajubu Jallo says one reason is overpopulation and people cutting down trees to build more houses. Trees help control soil and water, which helps stop major flooding. He also says many people are living in unsafe, flood-prone areas.
They've been building houses in creeks. They've been building houses under bridges. They've been building houses in slum areas. This has not helped at all.
Jallo says the government is looking to move people affected by flooding to low-cost housing in safe areas. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The Zimbabwe Election Commission says it is all set for the parliamentary by-elections in Ebsworth, Mreri and Marenda Central constituencies. All three will be contested by ZANU-PF and a few opposition parties. The Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, is boycotting the polls, demanding electoral and democratic reforms. Electoral Commissioner Rita Makaru told VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7 reporter Blessing Zulu that all logistics have been put in place for the by-elections.
We are ready now for the by-elections. We shall be deploying polling officers to their respective polling stations, and they will be carrying with them the relevant voting material. So I would say we are almost ready, waiting now for the voters to cast their ballots.
For ZEC, obviously, this is a dress rehearsal for 2018. Is it that significant? Are these by-elections significant for you as an organization?
Yes, we have been using by-elections, like you say, as training grounds, increasing on our efficiency with this by-election. But particularly this one, we have piloted a polling station-specific voter registration exercise in Marondera Central. We'll want to see how this goes, whether we have done it properly and adequately, and what lessons we can draw from the pilot exercise, particularly significant for us.
Just tell us briefly about this pilot project that you are launching in Marondera.
The pilot project that we are launching in Marondera is actually to demarcate what we call polling areas that are specific to each polling station, so that people in a particular polling area will just go to one polling station. The voters' roll for that polling station will be a smaller one, between 800 and 1,500 voters. It's easier for us to manage, it's easier for everybody to respect, and we want to see that how that goes, so that if we think it is the way to go, then we can replicate it for the 2018 elections.
Rita Makarao is the chairperson of Zimbabwe's Electoral Commission. She spoke with VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7 reporter Blessing Zulu from the capital, Harare. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
But anytime when she come around, she get this feeling where they do me like fever. And when she dance with my mezebu, he dey beat me like Senna for Fana. Me like how she play the bass line, it makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she that, it makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a jump. Daddy come to me across. And when they ask me, it wasn't me. That's so me talk say I don't like this shirt touching body. Cause you know say my mama don't like him. I don't want this shirt touching body. Cause you know say my papa don't like him. Listen up,
following.
Oh na 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 na. Oh na 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 na. I'm a man. Cause you know say my mama don't like him. I don't want this shirt touching body. Cause you know say my papa don't like him. Listen up,
son.
Oh na 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 na. However, don't try me, cause if you try, I go do you many things. If you doubt me, don't try me, cause if you try, I go do you many things. Like how she play the baseline, it makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she dat, it makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a jump. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's why me talk say, I don't like this shirt touching body. Cause you know say, my mama don't like him. I don't want this shirt touching body. Cause you know say, my papa don't like him. This is a
part of my desert.
Oh, na, 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 na.
Don't go for you. Baby, give me all your loving.
take your love for granted. Baby, baby, fire gojo. Baby, you and I just they go. Don't let bad man stop our flow. Baby, make we just they go. The money too much, I'm dashing. Are you feeling my singing? Buy whatever you're thinking. Can't you see what I'm feeling? Legas to Dubai, Abuja to Muzari, go back to Mumbai. Now is the music that wants to dance to you. Are you gonna dance you? If I show you my money, are you gonna dance you? If I show you the way, are you gonna dance you? If I show you my pocket, baby, are you gonna dance you? If I show you the wallet, I will show you the money. Baby, dance from you. Baby, move from you. Don't go from you. I will show you the money. I will, baby, dance from you. Show me your body. Don't go for you. I will show you the money. Baby, dance from you. Baby, move from you. Don't go for you. I will show you the money. I will, baby, dance from you. Show me your body. Don't go for you.
Karu, they come here every time. Karu, they dance, you know, they shine. Karu, they bust in my brain, bust in my brain.
Havana. You understand? Deja. Yeah, yeah.
Africa lady, Panya, Omo Panya, they scatter my brain, yo. Beautiful lady, yo. That can Africa lady, yo. I sing in the song for Panya, and I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything for Panya,
anything, yeah.
And I thank you the Lord for Panya,
hey. What is my baby name? She's my fine baby, baby, oh, she's my Africa baby,
lady, oh,
Panya sweet like a chocolate. When she come around, she a heavyweight. She a dance, she a move, immediate, baby. I am. Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name? I request for my baby girl.
And I thank you the Lord for Panya. You must love I have for you.
Abi,
hey. Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name? For my baby girl,
Panya, Panya,
Panya, Panya, scatter the fluff for me.
And that was music from the continent. Hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to address the audience of the Voice of America. Every week, I pay close attention to the U.S. policy towards the continent of Africa. Simultaneously, I look at African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, the big question of power, which came out of the president during his meeting with the heads of state here, was also echoed when he addressed the African governments in Addis Ababa. Power Africa is a very central argument from President Obama. There are a number of arguments made by the presidency at the White House, in the State Department, in the Energy Department, in the Commerce Department, and many other related agencies of the United States. Power Africa is very much linked to the Africans themselves. They may have different opinions based on their conflicting interests from country to country. One big issue coming out of this narrative is the decision of the Kenyan government to negotiate with the Chinese with regard to nuclear energy. This is a very interesting development with regard to Power Africa. Both the presidency here and the government in Kenya will be debating this issue just as it was under the Kennedy administration before his assassination and the government of Ghana under Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. The Volta Dam was a very central issue as foreign policy and domestic policy for the late Kwame Nkrumah. So the spirit of Kwame Nkrumah is back in time. And so when we are looking at African opinions on and attitudes towards energy, the legacy of Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, the Volta Dam, and the consequences for the Ghanaians comes back today. The Ghanaians may not talk about this, but I am sure that Ghanaians who are well informed will remember deja vu that the old issue of power is back. Chinese involvement in Africa was very limited at that time. But the Chinese were very much concerned about Africa, and this is what happened to the Trans-Am Railroad. The issue then was landlocked African countries and the question of railroads. Today, when you look at U.S. policy towards Africa, African business people will be forced by this new development. If people are willing to go back to history and see what the Kennedy administration was trying to do, and later on the LBJ administration had to do. But at that time, the overriding issue was the Cold War, Soviet power, Soviet interest. Today, if you go back to number two, you can see that one big issue for Africans in the United States again is Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone. Many Americans, many Africans, unfortunately, don't read history. And that's one reason why when we talk about Ebola, Ebola became a problem for the people of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, and other African countries, West African countries were affected. But people don't read history. If they read history, they will see that influenza was a disease that came from the Americans and the British affecting the Sierra Leoneans and Liberians because of their silos. Today, when we talk about genuine relationship between African countries and the United States, the African leaders and the American leaders had the opportunity to deal with disease when they came here. When the issue went back to the African conference in Addis Ababa, disease is not given serious attention. That is why you come back to the crisis in Sierra Leone with Ebola. So foreign policy for Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, and the West African countries must go back in business and come back to the United States for a serious negotiation. This is not an all-Africa issue. It has to be addressed immediately as a West African issue to deal with Ebola. And this is where influenza, malaria, and Ebola become diseases in African foreign policy, diseases in American foreign policy. And this is where you go back to your third issue, which is relevant now. You go back to Kwame Nkrumah, who tried to grapple with malaria. And malaria became a very important issue to the point that malaria became a metaphor, not only for Americans, English, Germans, and other people who are interested, because you have some of these scholars and some of people who are concerned about wars and disease in Africa. You go back to the writings of the late Ali Mazrui. He devoted his time to explain African problems in the Africans. When the legacies of President Obama are written after he come out of office, we will be educated fully. And I hope everyone who listens to this narrative will go back to the history books and see how disease, influenza, malaria, and now Ebola are still with us. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, always being in a hurry does not prevent death. Neither does going slowly prevent living. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has voiced deep disappointment over the conviction and sentencing of jailed Venezuelan opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez. Mr. Lopez was sentenced to nearly 14 years in prison on charges which included inciting violence during anti-government demonstrations last year. This despite public calls by Mr. Lopez at the time that all protests should be peaceful. Reportedly, the criminal indictment against him included the bizarre claim that he had incited people to violence through subliminal messages. In addition, not a single witness testified on his behalf during court proceedings that lasted more than 600 hours. Amnesty International, which regards Mr. Lopez as a prisoner of conscience, said his only so-called crime was being leader of an opposition party in Venezuela. Human Rights Watch called the case a travesty of justice, in which conviction followed a prosecution that did not present basic evidence of a crime. In a written statement, Secretary of State John Kerry said the decision by the Venezuelan court raises great concern about the political nature of the judicial process and verdict, and the use of the Venezuelan judicial system to suppress and punish government critics. Mr. Kerry noted that since Mr. Lopez's arrest in 2014, the United States has underscored our concern with the charges brought against Mr. Lopez, which we consider illegitimate, and we have repeatedly called for his release and for the release of all Venezuelans who are imprisoned for political reasons. We call on the government of Venezuela to respect the rights of all political prisoners and to guarantee fair and transparent public trial, consistent with the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man, the Inter-American Democratic Charter, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and Venezuela's Constitution. The White House also spoke out about Mr. Lopez's case. National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price said in a statement that the decision to prosecute and sentence Lopez and the conduct of his trial have highlighted significant failures in the rule of law and judicial system in Venezuela, noting that respect for the rights of citizens to engage in political discourse and express political views without risk of detention or harassment are essential to a functioning democracy. Mr. Price called on the government of Venezuela to release Lopez, as well as all other political prisoners who remain unjustly detained.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.